This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. While we may be most familiar with the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, there have been exactly five mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth. Catastrophic periods where biological diversity and the sheer number of living organisms on the planet were reduced by staggering proportions. In her latest book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker asks whether we are right now living in the midst of another mass extinction, one caused not by an asteroid or an ice age, but by us, the human race. The Sixth Extinction is being released on paperback in January, and I spoke to Elizabeth Colbert earlier this year. So I'm just going to throw this out there. This book didn't exactly make me feel very great about the human race.
Well, I think that one of the points that I do try to make, and you can make of this what you will, is that a lot of our best qualities are creativity, our inventiveness, you know, our interest in other people, and even our interest in the world, our restlessness, are tied to the ways that we're impacting the world and causing this mass extinction event. So you could say that that's happy, or you could say that that's unhappy. I'm gonna leave it to you. How's that?
Okay. Well, like I said, unfortunately, I guess I took the cynical view.
Okay. But. Okay.
So I was born into a world where many endangered animals were and are the norm. So I sort of grew up thinking that I guess that extinction is in some way a natural part of evolution. But you write that throughout most of history, it's actually extremely rare.
Yes, that is. I'm glad you brought that up because that is really one of the main points of the book. It's a very simple one. We are so inured to extinction. We read about it all the time that we just say, oh, that's, you know, just part of the way things are. And I've had people say to me, you know, point blank, oh, isn't this just the sort of the natural order? And the important thing to realize is that extinction in the natural order, so, you know, understood over vast periods of time, the whole history of life, is actually extremely rare. It's got to be rarer when you think about it. It's got to be rarer than speciation. Then we see new species created, and we don't see new species popping up all the time.
Sort of like the birth rate is generally higher than the death rate.
Exactly. Otherwise, the planet would be depopulated, right? I mean, these are pretty basic mathematical concepts.
So what is the extinction rate now, and how does that compare to the sort of quote-unquote pre-Homo sapiens average?
Yeah, well, it's hundreds, perhaps thousands of times what scientists refer to as the background rate, and that background rate is different for different groups of organisms, and it's usually calculated just by going through vast databases of fossils and trying to figure out how long the average species lives. So, you know, in the case of let's say a mammal, you know, that might be a few million years that the average species tends to live. And we see now, as I say, extinction rates that are hundreds, perhaps thousands, perhaps in some groups even tens of thousands of times higher than they seem to be in the fossil record. And, you know, those are only, unfortunately, increasing.
So before we get, I guess, to this concept of the sixth extinction, I wanted to go back and look at the big five mass extinctions thus far. I said in the intro, most of us have sort of a basic impression about that great big asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. But what about those other four? What are the stories behind those?
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, we're talking about events that happened tens, hundreds of millions of years ago. So they're sort of, you know, murder mystery cases with a very, very cold trail. But the first of these major mass extinctions was about 440 million years ago. And interestingly enough, that is the time when life was still really confined to the water. So that was a really devastating event for aquatic life, but not for terrestrial life, because there simply was no life on land. And it's pretty, seems pretty clear that that was caused by this weird cold event, a very sudden glaciation event that is hard to explain, but the world got a lot colder pretty quickly at that moment. The most devastating of all of these events was what's known as the end Permian extinction, and that occurred about 250 million years ago. And there's a book that's been written about that extinction by a British paleontologist, and it's called When Life Nearly Died. It got very, very close, perilously close, to eliminating multicellular life altogether. So that was a really devastating event. And that seems to have been caused, and this is where some very, very frightening parallels occur to one, by a really massive outflux of carbon dioxide.
Well, that, I guess that makes me ask, you know, how do we, this sixth extinction, compared to, say, an asteroid or, you know, a glacial event?
Well, I guess the honest answer to that would be we're not exactly sure. But people are very interested right now, particularly in this end Permian extinction, precisely because there seem to be some pretty scary parallels here. When you emit lots of carbon dioxide really fast, as we're doing and as happened at the end of the Permian period, a couple things happen. First of all, as you say, you raise global temperatures because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so that just follows pretty naturally, you know, despite what some people would say about the debate over climate change. That's just really a pretty basic geophysical fact. So you got massive global warming at the end of the Permian. And also you get a phenomenon that's also sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, which is a lot of CO2 dissolves in the oceans. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. And it's a weak acid. You know, you drink it when you drink a Coke, that's carbonated water. But
we all know what happens if you drink too much Coke.
Exactly. And it if you pour enough of it, you know, into the water, you change the water, the chemistry of the water. And that's happening. That's measurable. That's observable. That's, you know, not debatable either. And at the end of the Permian period, you also got this massive event of what's become known as ocean acidification. And we are seeing ocean acidification now. And that's another parallel that's not a very happy parallel.
Pretty cheery stuff here. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Now, I feel like I have to ask this for the sake of argument, but aren't Homo sapiens a quote-unquote sort of natural part of the world? And, you know, no matter how many species we are directly or indirectly responsible for their extinction, isn't that too, in effect, I guess, a natural part of life and death on Earth?
I think that, you know, becomes kind of a semantic question, I suppose. I mean, is an asteroid natural? You know, yeah, it didn't have any... It's not supernatural as that. So to the extent that, you know, we are organic beings, or the asteroid wasn't even an organic being, but, you know, to the extent that we're part of this ecosystem that's the planet, we depend on it, yeah, we're natural. But, you know, I'm not sure that really makes any difference at the end of the day. And in some ways it's only all the more sobering because, you know, we are dependent on this system. We are very much implicated in the natural world, whether we choose to believe that or not. So when you set really massive changes in motion, you know, to your own home planet, you kind of have to be wondering, you know, where that's going to lead.
Well, I guess that same argument would say that if there was an extinction of the human race, that was also natural, which is not something we're probably too fond of thinking about.
Exactly.
So if this sixth extinction is already taking place, what kind of efforts are underway to catalog and archive species before they disappear, given that it sounds like for many of them, the damage has already been done?
Well, there are lots and lots of efforts going on. I mean, there are these, for example, just to give you one kind of effort that's going on, there are these like rapid assessment teams that go out into pretty remote parts of the world and try to catalog absolutely everything that's there. Precisely with this idea of, well, who knows if we come back in 20 years, you know, what's going to be here. So that's, you know, just one effort. But there are massive efforts going on in all ecosystems, all parts of the world, really, to catalog what's there. But, you know, the problem is that it's a very, very time-consuming work and very specialized work. And there are a lot of species out there. We do not know how many species we share this planet with, you know, really even to an order of magnitude, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, you write about one kind of weird effort, I guess, freezing animals, like in sort of like Ted Williams' Head.
Yeah, exactly. That was a really interesting trip. I went out to San Diego to something called the Frozen Zoo, which, you know, sounds like a zoo, but really it's not the kind of zoo you'd really want to visit. And what it really is just a bunch of vats of liquid nitrogen. And in these vats are cell lines, right? So we can get cells to grow, you know, in a petri dish, basically, and then freeze them, put them into sort of a state of suspended animation. And some very, very highly endangered animals, and in one case, the cells of an animal that is now extinct are now, you know, and I use this term in quotes, living on in these vats of liquid nitrogen.
Scientists in Russia have talked about cloning a woolly mammoth. I was reading about this morning. Just one of several examples of a movement towards something called de-extinction. With all the still living species now on the endangered list, doesn't that seem a little odd to you?
Well, I think de-extinction is one of those ideas that really captures the public's imagination.
Yeah, but who doesn't want to see a woolly mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger?
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, count me in, you know, when the woolly mammoth shows up, I'm going to be first to buy a ticket.
Oh, we can go together.
Okay, great. Yeah. But I do want to say that there are, you know, when you start to really look at the idea in any kind of rigorous ways, there are huge obstacles, both just technically, you know, we don't have any woolly mammoth cells around. We don't have any woolly mammoth, for example, in the frozen zoo. So you have to genetically engineer a woolly mammoth cell. And right now we are not capable of doing that. Then you've got to get, you know, that to become an embryo, you've got to get some other animal to carry it to term, right? Woolly mammoths don't just come full-blown into the world. They have, you know, very long gestation periods. And then let's say you even overcame all of those hurdles. The point is made that animals are more than their genome, right? So like if you raised a human, if you could create a human, there were no more humans, you created a human baby, you know, that baby wouldn't really be human if it was raised in a tank. And ditto for that woolly mammoth. Woolly mammoths, you know, presumably had very sophisticated societies, just like elephants, and they had to learn a lot from their social group members. So, you know, what do you have when you have one member of a species? It's kind of a creepy thought.
Wow. Well, like I said, it's a tough conversation. Is it sort of too late to turn the tide?
Well, I think that, you know, we tend to always see things in these stark terms, like, okay, either all hope is lost or you know, everything's going to be fine. And I think, unfortunately, the truth is very much in the middle. It's not too late for, you know, pretty much everything that's still out there. It's obviously too late for those things, you know, that aren't out there anymore, of which there are, unfortunately, an increasing number every week, practically. But we're talking about turning a battleship, you know, that's headed in one direction right now. You know, you could argue that we're really sort of maximizing our impacts on the planet. We're changing the atmosphere, we're changing the chemistry of the ocean, we're moving things around that often in ways that often have devastating effects. We're, you know, mowing down the rainforest. So we're really doing all the things that on some level we know we shouldn't be doing, and we're probably doing a bunch of things, you know, that we don't even not even aware of the impacts that they're having. So we really need to do, be working on a lot of different levels to try to minimize our impacts. So I think a lot of damage has been done. A lot of damage is probably close to inevitable at this point, but a lot of damage is not close to inevitable at this point, and that is a choice that we still have to make.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her latest book, The Sixth Extinction, is out now and will be released in paperback in January. Coming up, we tone things down from ruining the planet to ruining your eardrums. Why, despite the risks, so many musicians and fans just won't wear earplugs. Stick around.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In some musical circles, there's an unspoken commandment when it comes to live concerts. The louder, the better.
You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly.
What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly.
Unfortunately, for Spinal Tap's Nigel Tufnell, turning your amp up to 11 doesn't by definition make music sound better, clearer, or more rock and roll. In fact, a lifetime of overly loud music can leave fans and musicians forced to listen to something nobody wants to hear.
One of the most common forms of tinnitus is called ringing tinnitus, and it is just a tone, something like this.
About 50 million Americans suffer from tinnitus, or ringing in the ears, among them Neil Young, Eric Clapton, Metallica's drummer Lars Ulrich, and Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. Despite the risks, many musicians and fans don't protect themselves by wearing earplugs, or, the obvious choice, turning down the volume on their earbuds and headsets. To find out more, Virginia spoke to Molly Boscheman, a concert photographer and contributor to Pitchfork. She wrote about tinnitus and the cultural bias against wearing earplugs.
How loud is too loud for our ears to handle?
There's sort of a threshold of 85 decibels that most audiologists agree is a threshold after which long-term exposure, which means anything more than a half hour as a general rule, is dangerous. What happens is tinnitus is actually a neurological problem that originates in the brain, and it involves the miscommunication between noise-damaged sensory cells in our brain. So when our ears get jostled by very, very loud volumes of noise, like an explosion or noise coming from a rock concert, there's a failure of those noise transmitters to properly communicate impulses to the auditory nerve in the brain, which is a long, convoluted way of saying you shake it too much, it'll never stop ringing. And small venues where sound is trapped and sort of recirculated and reverberating against these hard materials like the concrete of a warehouse or the concrete of a basement where you might be attending a small show, will trap and reverberate sound such that even if it is played at 85 decibels, which the average rock concert is not, it's more like 110 decibels, the volume can sort of get ratcheted up with sort of an echo effect.
Well, that puts people, musicians and people who work in the live music industry, as well as, you know, I'm guessing people who operate jackhammers or something, at the highest risk of ear damage. But as you point out, people in the audience don't always protect themselves, and musicians don't always either. Is there a stigma against wearing earplugs in some professional music circles?
I definitely think, depending on the genre, you see this more. For example, a lot of punk music and metal music, as well as the historic loud rock and roll, any sort of genre of music that has a certain visceral nature where the experience is supposed to be very cathartic because it's, you know, so loud and uninhibited and explosive. Those genres, I do think there is a sort of unspoken stigma about wearing earplugs. You know, it's sort of like the equivalent of, you know, plugging your nose over a chef's food would be to wear earplugs in a concert setting where by nature you may be expected to experience some sort of not quite direct like physical pain, but a sort of shock. You know, in those cases, I definitely think there is a conscious decision not to wear earplugs, even if you might end up with some ringing in your ears, because maybe people associate it with a job well done on the part of the musician.
And I guess there's also the sort of, you know, there's the devil may care attitude, or I don't want to grow old anyway, so who cares if my ears are ringing? Well, there are lots of debates also as to whether the earplug actually diminishes the concert experience. Objectively speaking, would you rather go see a band play at a safe volume, or would you rather wear earplugs and have them play really loud?
I would love for musicians and for venues to play music at safe levels to begin with. But since for a confluence of factors, that's not necessarily possible today, there hasn't been a big dialogue about why music is played this loud. And I think there's a miscommunication between the audience and people who work in the venues and musicians who aren't necessarily always aware of how loud they are because speakers are facing away from them. That kind of leads to this. There's not really a public dialogue going on about this issue. And as a result, I don't think many venues are going to be playing music at safe volumes anytime soon. And as a result, I would definitely encourage anyone who loves music and experiences it in the live setting to consider wearing earplugs. which most audiologists agree, you won't lose a significant amount of sound or anything vital to the mix by wearing earplugs. You can only protect yourself.
All right, we've talked a lot about live shows, Molly. How about wearing earbuds? Is there a maximum level that we should be turning up our earbuds to?
It's interesting. When you read the information on the earbuds that come with, say, an iPod, the literature actually suggests that, you know, listening to concentrated streams of music at very high volumes can be dangerous. But conveniently, they don't quite tell us how loud that is. Is that with the volume all the way up at 11, for example, like in the Spinal Tap clip that we heard? Or is that anything above the midway point? I would say, you know, there's never such thing as too much music as long as you're listening to it at a safe level. So, you know, if you're going to blast your iPod for that moment on the subway just to cancel out a short-lived conversation that you don't want to hear, that's probably okay. But if you're walking around 24 hours plugged in, playing and listening to music at a maximum volume, perhaps you should reconsider your daily activities.
All right, Molly Boschman, who, as we heard, only occasionally turns it up to 11, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Molly Boschman is a concert photographer and contributor to Pitchfork. You'll find a link to her article, How Loud is Too Loud? That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we'll use another one of our five senses when the Word of Mouth team does a water taste test. And I'll speak with America's only water sommelier. That's after the news.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever been faced with the daunting task of choosing a wine from a long list at a fine restaurant, you may have enlisted the help of a wine sommelier. The sommelier is an expert who's charged with creating the wine list, procuring the selections, and guiding patrons on which wines will pair best with their meals. But what happens when you're not sure what kind of water to order? Our next guest can help you with that decision. Martin Risa is America's only water sommelier. He's also the general manager at Ray's and Stark Bar at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, which boasts a 44-page water menu. And Martin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, thank you for being on the show.
A 44-page water menu, it seems kind of overwhelming. How are the different waters arranged? Is it like wine where certain waters are paired with chicken and others are paired with steak?
So my water list starts kind of with the countries. So it's alphabetically in order by countries because every single country has beautiful springs. And the really funny thing is, and a lot of people still don't believe that actually, and this is my part right now here in America, that water is not just water. Water actually has taste. It all depends on the mineral level where the water is coming from. And every single country and every single grounds has different mineral levels, and therefore you can actually taste the terroir of the water.
So, I mean, I can understand that in the sense that I have had, I have had tap water that I thought tasted funny. But I guess the degree of difference here, maybe in terms of taste of water, is not the same as taste of, say, wines from lowest quality to highest.
No, correct. You're absolutely right. What I'm saying, like, by wine, it's kind of similar, but you should think it's all about, like, one grape and the water, the grape calls water. So, for example, it's not about, like, a Pinot Noir tastes differently than a Cabernet Sauvignon or, like, a Riesling to a Sauvignon Blanc. By water, it's more like, imagine you have a Riesling from Washington State and a Riesling from Germany and a Riesling from California, and they're all tasting slightly different. And this is the same what we're doing in water. So they're all tasting slightly different, but it's not like that this one water suddenly is red and the other water suddenly yellow.
So let's stick with this wine comparison. When people try wines, you know, there's a variety of rituals, you know, smelling the wine, swirling the glass for oxygen, palate cleansers. Now, do you have a process for when you drink water that's similar?
I'm always checking, first of all, the taste or actually the smell of the glass, because glasses can have a smell as well. It depends when they're not really cleaned. Actually, you're doing the same when you're doing wine tastings. You're always like pushing a little bit air in your glass with your nose to and then like inhale this air to see if actually the glass is like completely free of odors. That's extremely important by water, because water should be odorless. And when you have suddenly like a like disturbing odor from a water glass, that really doesn't give you the whole experience in water. The second thing is literally like I'm drinking like in a water tasting the same what I would do in a wine tasting. I'm actually not chilling down my waters because I want to have like the whole like experience of a water. And it's all by wine tastings as well. When you're chilling down all your wines extremely down, you will not taste anymore all the aspects of the wine. So when you're chilling down a beverage, and I know Americans love to chill down beverages, but they're sometimes actually losing the ability of taste profiles or the drinks, what they're actually drinking. So stick away from ice cubes and this kind of things, especially by water tasting. And then I'm like swirling it. I'm putting oxygen as well into my mouth to see like the whole flavor access to gain my palate. And I'm drinking water the same like what I would do in a wine tasting, except for one big thing. I don't have to spit it out. That's a beautiful thing about a water tasting. I can get drunk.
Yeah, but you must have to go to the bathroom all the time.
I'm tasting water professional since 2005, and I don't want to know how many times I'm spending on the bathrooms.
So in 2010, you received your certification as a mineral water sommelier from the German Mineral Water Trade Association. Now, was there a lot of training or an exam that went into that?
So it was kind of interesting. I told you since 2005, I'm doing like water tastings and I'm rethinking my use of water. Because a customer came up to my restaurant and said, "Hey, Martin, you'd have 1,500 different positions of wine, but you just have one water brand. And I don't like that water brand. Do you have something else for me?" And he kind of opened my eyes, because I realized as a child already that water has taste. And I thought like, hey, here we are in the restaurant business. It's all about options. And when it comes to water, we're just saying sparkling, flat, or tap. And this, I think, should be changed, because water has taste. So I created this water menu. I started to drink water all the time. I wrote a book in 2008, actually, about water. It's 200 pages thick. And then in 2010, the Water Trade Association came up to me and said, "Martin, you have so much knowledge. We should give you a certification for that, because we need people like you to tell other people that water is not just water." So in 2010, I received my certification. But it's more like learning by doing what I did. But I know that there are other schools now in Germany, but I'm obviously now in America. You can get a 2 or 3 week course, and you've been then a certified water sommelier as well.
So has anybody ever tried to pull a fast one on you and just, tell you that you're tasting a water from the Alps or that's melted from a glacier, when it's really, in fact, just tap water to sort of test your abilities?
Oh, all the time. It's normal for me, actually. That's my daily basis here. My wife and I went to Vegas for like 3 months ago, and we went over there to a restaurant and they recognized me. And it's kind of scary, actually. I'm here since 3.5 years, and then people recognize me as a water sommelier. I don't know if I'm really feeling comfortable with that. I just want to give options to my guests. That's pretty much it, what I want to do. But still, I came to this restaurant, and they had 3 glasses of water right in front of me. One was Las Vegas tap and 2 other spring waters. And I tasted right away the Las Vegas tap water. And they looked at me like, "Oh my God, you really can do it." He's saying, "Yeah, sure, definitely, I can do it. I'm not like trying to pretend to do something. I'm actually a thirsty guy."
Martin, can you be sure that a bottled water comes from the place that it's advertised as coming from? I've heard that the industry, forgive the pun, I've heard that the industry isn't always transparent.
The industry is transparent. You just have to look at the labels. And here in America, the laws are very, very strict about this. And when it says purified water, that means actually it comes from a tap water source or something like this. So bottled water is not just bottled water. And we're thinking, oh, we have tap water and we have just bottled water. Bottled water has huge differences. So we're starting with purified water. That means it's actually nothing else than tap water. Then we have spring water, comes from the spring where it's labeled on. And we have mineral water, what has to have a TDS level. And TDS stands for total dissolved solids. So that means it has a lot of minerals in it, at least by 500 TDS or more. So these are the 3 aspects of bottled water, what you can buy here in America.
So how do you win over the naysayers then, who say that water has no taste, that say that there's no difference between them, and that, you know, you shouldn't be paying more or less for a certain type of water because of its mineral content? Do you have a pitch for them, or do you just let it lie?
I have a pitch definitely for them, and a 100% success rate on that pitch. They just have to come to my restaurant. I will get them a small water flight with three different waters, and everybody's realizing, oh my God, water actually has a taste. And then it's all about preference. When people are saying LA Tap is fine for me, I would never argument with that. Sure, that's their taste. Great, wonderful. I'm providing water for people. So for me, actually, it doesn't matter what you want to drink. It's for me about which water would be the best for your palate, for your health. And this is the reason where I'm coming in then and will tell you, hey, you should maybe try this water. You should try this water. This water has that impact on that wine. And then it's getting interesting and fascinating. And I have to say as well, like, a lot of kids love the water menu. They come into my restaurant. They think, first of all, it's so funny because every single water has like its own page with a bottle shape and everything. So they love to look in it. And kids have the ability because their palate is so unique still. And it's not like ruined kind of by all the spices what we're eating over our whole life, that they can really taste water very uniquely in a very unique way. And they love to do water tastings. They feel like grown up. They suddenly can do tastings. They're getting wine glasses from me and they can zip in the different waters. They love the whole experience.
Well, Martin, I'll raise a toast to that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Always, always. Thank you.
Martin Risa is the general manager and water sommelier at Rays and Stark Bar at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. We've got links to find out more at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, Martin was so convincing, we decided to engineer our own little water taste test. So producer Logan Shannon hit the grocery store, cleaned a few of her nicest tumblers, so no weird glass smell. And she and senior producer Maureen McMurray joined me in the studio to sample some high-quality H2O.
Okay, so we're going to start with Voss.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
So this is from Norway.
Well, I rinsed my mouth out with tap to get the morning coffee out of my mouth, and mm-hmm. this is much smoother.
So Martin's notes for Voss was that it would be slightly bitter and metallic.
Oh, I'm definitely not getting that.
Okay. So the next one we're going to try is Fiji water, which is a pretty iconic bottle.
And it's more expensive whenever I go into like a gas station or something. If I'm feeling fancy, I'll get the Fiji.
Yeah. It's definitely high-end water.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this tastes more like tap to me. Like there's more of a minerally flavor.
Or something like musty.
a musty mineral flavor.
His tasting notes on this were fruity and smooth.
No.
Fruity? That is a joke. It's water.
All right.
I wish I could taste what he tastes.
I know.
This is so sad.
I know. Well, now we will move on to the sparkling mineral waters. So this is San Pellegrino, which I would say most restaurants serve if you ask for sparkling water.
This, I mean, obviously it has a taste.
Yeah.
I think the hard thing for me is that most of the water that I drink to counteract all the coffee. And so this, of all the waters we've tasted, is the only one thus far that I can actually enjoy a little bit because it has some taste and texture, and it's not just I'm trying to hydrate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has a little personality to it.
Yeah, it's got a little zing. We've got one more
left. We've got one more, and this is also from Italy. This is Blue Italy, which you can buy at Trader Joe's.
Already, it sounds more aggressive.
Oh, that is totally and utterly different.
Wow, yeah.
That one absolutely is.
Mm.
Even the aftertaste.
Well, the fizz fizzed harder and faster on my tongue. I'm not sure which one. I think I like the San Pellegrino better.
I do too.
And I would choose Hawaiian for my still. I really liked that water.
I'm going for the still simply based on the bottle design with Voss.
Oh, yeah.
I think for the still water, I'm going with tap.
Because it's free.
Because it's free. All right. Well done. Thank you. Cheers. If you'd like to try your own water taste test, water sommelier Martin Risa suggested a few to try. We've got more info plus a link to his 44-page water menu at wordofmouthradio.org. Here in the U.S., getting water is as easy as turning on a faucet. In Nepal, however, it can be very serious business. Reporter Lauren Spiro discovered this for herself when she spent 9 months living with a family in a small farming village in central Nepal. And she brings us this story.
The water tap closest to our house is a small concrete pen with a spout protruding from a rock. There's usually a scattering of people, mostly women and girls chattering nonchalantly around a cluster of tin jugs. But don't be deceived. This is a battleground. Now, there are rules. Rule number one, you must adhere at all times to a strict system of maneuvering. It works like this. As I arrive, I set down my tin jugs close to the spout, but not too close. Confident, but not cocky. I am now in line. Rule number two, there is no line. It's a virtual line where everyone takes note of who has arrived when. Still, your place must be defended as your turn approaches by moving closer to the spout, vigilantly, but not presumptuously. Rule number three, the virtual line is enforced through joint regulation. We watch for cheaters who move their jugs in too close, too quickly. Cheaters are handled with varying degrees of severity, depending on their age, status, and ferocity. I lack all three of these advantages, so for me, outright cheating is not an option. However, that brings us to rule number four. Tactical alliances may be arranged. This is my specialty. Let's say an aggressor places their water jug under the spout when it's my turn. I exchange glances with, say, Lakshmi, the girl who does housework for the school headmaster. Lakshmi climbs up behind the water spout, thereby monopolizing access, and then shouts, "Laura, Dee Dee, sister!" as if my name is a football play. I hand her my water jug, and she hooks it right under the spout until the offender has removed their vessel from underneath it. And then, to prove a point, when my jug is full, I hand Lakshmi hers, so that there's never an opening for challenge. Then we declare victory and walk home together while the old ladies yell after us. Rule five is the trickiest. The water tap involves all kinds of unspoken social conventions that are completely invisible to the uninitiated. For example, you may find, as I did on a particularly busy day, that just as you arrive, a woman will begin to yell at you in a furious tumble of incomprehensible words. And you may think, quite correctly, I am in full accordance with the system of maneuvering, as you make your way, at the proper speed, towards the water spout. But then, the woman will take a palmful of water and toss it into your face for no reason whatsoever. Back at the house, Amma is waiting for me, and I cry indignantly that her only American daughter has been mistreated at the water tap. Amma sighs and then explains, I must have stood too close to low caste water jugs. And in the Hindu caste system, water is a conductor of impurity. The tainted object, in this case, me, can be cleansed with a sprinkling of water that has touched gold, such as an earring. Our neighbor had been looking out for my high-caste Brahmin family by purifying the foolish foreign water girl. So much for the system. Some rules can only be learned on the job.
That piece came to us from the World Vision Report. Coming up, life at the water cooler. Why office gossip can actually be good for your career. Stick around. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever sat down for lunch with your coworkers, chances are you've experienced a conversation something like this.
Who's getting married?
Nobody.
Somebody doesn't tell me, I'm going to start screaming.
It's Eric and Megan.
Oh, hey, I hired them. Matchmaker. Places like Spaniard Fly.
We're not getting married, it's just talk.
Did everybody know about this but me?
There's nothing to know, it's just gossip.
That's a scene from the season 6 opener of the show The Office, aptly titled Gossip. Whether in the workplace or amongst friends, gossip is an activity that most people scorn publicly and relish privately. Talking about people behind their backs is not always nice, but what if gossip was actually good and useful? Julie Beck is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the Health Channel. And Julie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is the argument in favor of gossip? What's the benefit?
Yeah, so the benefits are sort of coming from the perspective of evolutionary psychology. You know, people tend to say, you know, that they don't like people who gossip or they hate gossip, but they all do it. We all do it. There's been studies that say, like, up to 2/3 of all people's conversation topics are gossip. So it's happening a lot. And, you know, if we're doing something that much, there has to be kind of a good reason for it. And one of the reasons that people have sort of put out there is that we are able to learn about social norms from gossip and learn about things that people are doing that we can't actually witness ourselves. And as humans sort of became more and more populous on the planet, that became advantageous.
So there's so many people, we need gossip to sort of inform us about the norm. Maybe you can give us like a workplace example and why it would be good.
Yeah, so I think when you talk about gossip reinforcing social norms, maybe what you originally think of is sort of bad social norms, like maybe in like the high school cafeteria, people, you know, reinforcing the norm of what you should or shouldn't be wearing.
Right.
But it can also be helpful in that, you know, maybe you've started a new job. Maybe, you know, there are some sort of unspoken expectations from your boss or something, and you can learn about those, you know, through sort of gossiping with your coworkers.
So maybe, like, somebody starts and, you know, after a few conversations, you decide, like, well, this person seems pretty nice. I'm just going to pull them aside and let them know that, listen, John from logistics is crazy. Don't talk to that guy.
Yeah, that could be helpful for you.
Okay, so, and just by the way, there is no John from logistics at NHPR, so this is an entirely fabricated example.
Yeah.
But moving forward, when does that gossip, when does it stop being helpful for gleaning social cues and start becoming hurtful or maybe malicious?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that it really depends on the group. You know, there was this wasn't part of my article, but there was another study recently that was talking about how certain high schools become cliquey and certain ones don't. Huh. And it just sort of depends on the environment that you have. And I think that's why, you know, in some offices you may have the useful, you know, stay away from John from logistics gossip, whereas in other offices that maybe are slightly less friendly environment, you might have people talking about each other behind their backs or, you know, sort of reinforcing the norm that, you know, we don't go above and beyond here because we all want to, you know, get home early and clock out and whatever. So it really depends on sort of the people and the environment that you find yourself in.
Yeah, it does seem like gossip it's a fine line between gossip and maybe bullying. And you know, especially right now with the ability to bully people anonymously online and that being a big problem, it does seem like this must be a case where if it's good, it's only because it's in moderation.
Yeah, I think that can be true, but I also think that there is sort of a difference between the social conception of gossip and the sort of scientific conception of gossip, because when you talk about gossip in a sort of casual context, you are usually giving it the negative connotation, whereas really in the sort of, you know, when people are studying it in scientific literature, it's really only, you know, when you are talking about somebody who's not present. So, you know, I mean, right. You could just be like, oh, did you hear, like, so-and-so won an award for this? I mean, I don't know. That would still technically be gossip.
Okay, so I see what you're saying. Is there any benefit to you know, me if I'm gossiping? Does that have any effect on my mood? Does that influence me negatively or positively at all?
It can, yeah. So another theory that's sort of been bandied about is that if people gossip, it sort of exists to punish rule breakers. And again, that can be good or bad. But say, you know, somebody is maybe likely to cheat you in a business deal or something. And if you've just gotten cheated, it actually, there's some research that suggests that even if it's not going to, you know, improve your situation at all financially, if you go and tell somebody else, oh, you know, John's a cheater, don't do business with him, then that actually reduces, you know, sort of your negative emotions and makes you feel better about the situation because you might have protected somebody else.
So are these studies meant to make us feel better about what we already do or encourage us to engage in more, maybe more thoughtful gossip?
I don't know if the researchers would necessarily say they're trying to encourage people to gossip, but I think it's just one of those things where people are starting to look at a phenomenon that we know very well and sort of assume that everyone does and also assume is really just sort of negative and that we're doing it for our own sort of, you know, sadistic pleasure, and looking at why in a societal context and evolutionarial context that we might want to do that, or it might be advantageous sort of as a social behavior. So we're just sort of seeing more nuances there that we didn't necessarily see before.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Julie Beck is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the Health Channel. You can find a link to her article, Have You Heard? Gossip is Actually Good and Useful. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And Julie, just tell me a little bit, what's it like at The Atlantic?
Are you asking me about the gossip culture at The Atlantic?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, just, you know.
The Atlantic is a wonderful place to work. It's a very friendly and supportive environment, so I think we're lucky in that regard.
All right, your coworkers are going to appreciate that. I gave you the opportunity. You didn't take it. So
I know.
That does it for today's show. Thanks for spending some time with us. Earlier in the program, you may have heard us chatting with America's only water sommelier, Martin Risa. Yes, you heard that right. He is a water sommelier. If you want to put your palate to the test to find out if you can tell the difference between various artisanal waters, he did provide us with a handy list of waters to try. You'll find that at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.